Happy Indigenous Peoples Day, and welcome to the Jewish Diasporas, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Ben Yanowitz
and Zach Smarin. In the spirit of the hour, we would like to dedicate this episode to the one and only great crusader against anti-Semitism serving at His Majesty's pleasure, Sir Keith Starmer.
We would also like to dedicate this episode to the 248th anniversary of the American Declaration of Independence, which launched the original anti-imperialist revolution, which continues to inspire anti-imperialist practice around the world.
Anyway, today we are talking to Joe Feinberg, an organizer with the Prague-based Židovský hlas solidarnosti, or Jewish Voice of Solidarity in Czech.
Feeling that nation-states confine our political imaginations, Feinberg and his colleagues authored a Declaration of Independence of Diaspora, which, while directly satirizing the Israeli Declaration of Independence, provokes crucial questions about how self-determination can be manifested by diasporic peoples.
In our conversation, Feinberg explains why he challenges the Jewishness of the State of Israel and provides a nuanced understanding of Zionism's impact on Jewish life. He then goes on to read this diasporist declaration in full, allowing us to collectively explore its implications and poetry.
For the full text, as well as an article by Joe that serves as a good companion piece to the declaration, check out the links in the description.
Thank you so much to our donors. If you like what we are doing here, please rate our show on your podcast platform of choice, consider supporting us on Patreon, follow us on Instagram at the Jewish Diasporist Pod, and share our content with your communities. Every donation, like, follow, and share makes a big difference.
Without further ado, enjoy the show.
Great to have you here, Joe. Thank you so much for coming. Would you just like to start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, yeah. Well, thanks a lot for having me. I am a fan of the podcast. So yeah, good chance to talk about the meaning of diaspora, which there's so much to talk about. Well, I live in Prague, so the most immediate experience I'll be talking about is being kind of on the margins of the Prague Jewish community. I'll get to that in a minute. I grew up in small town Ohio without being part of a very active Jewish community. So it's only part of my family that has Jewish background. And you know, I would say they're pretty secularized. Some members of the extended family more interested in Jewish tradition and legacy than others. So it was sort of something I could take or leave in the way I was raised. I guess the way I look at it is, for a really long time, I kind of felt like I was so far from lived Jewishness, aside from doing a few things like celebrating Hanukkah, you know, visiting my grandma in New York City, bringing back dozens of bagels to Ohio every time I go visit her. Things that I feel like are kind of, in some ways, a quintessential modern American secular Jewish experience. But there was some part of me that felt like being more Jewish than that would be a little bit like claiming too much. And I think also at some point I became like aware of the fact that my grandfather's native language was Yiddish, but that had been completely erased by my generation, or forgotten, let's say. I would sort of thought like it would just be too artificial for me to try to recuperate that thing that's so alienated from me. And I think also I didn't feel a strong need for it when I was living in the United States, where there was such an active, especially in university. I come from a university town, and then I went to college in Grinnell College in Iowa, small town, but there was a pretty active Jewish community there, which I took part in, but I was like other people kind of teaching me things rather than me being very active. And I didn't feel the need to be, you know, other people were active, so I didn't have to be active. I would say there are two things about coming to Europe that made me feel like this Jewish legacy is more important to me now. One of those things is just this feeling of having been in a place where so much of the Jewish past has been erased. And this feeling of like, if I don't do it, who is going to do it? Or the people who do it maybe very differently than I would like to do it. And then I had experienced Jewishness at the university, for example, you know, progressive, more leftist interpretations of what it means to be Jewish. That was kind of this feeling that, yeah, like that should be there. And also the push against this central Eastern European, also even Western European modern sense of the nation state as the state belonging to one specific nation. And me being there, I mean, I didn't come as a Jew to the Czech Republic, but being there, being not fully Czech, kind of recognizing Jewishness as a tradition of thinking about not being fully a part of some community that declares itself to be complete. You know, medieval Christendom declared itself to be a complete community that didn't need anything outside it, and yet it was never complete. And Jewish tradition got trained to think about what this means to be in a place like that. So I felt like it's kind of, this is a legacy that I could feel as a, gives me a language to think about being here, being part of this community where I live, and not being completely absorbed in it, let's say. So that was one thing that maybe is very specific to my experience, something that I think is much more, a much bigger shared experience that I'm sure many of our listeners will share with me, is also the increasing explanation and justification of Israeli policy in the name of all Jews, which of course is not new in itself, but it feels like it's been escalating over recent years. And the more Israel would declare that it is doing X, this is what being Jewish means, the more, say, Czech Jewish communities would say, whatever Israel does, that's what Jews need to support because we're Jews, et cetera, speaking in our name, is the way so many people have put it. The more you hear that, for me, the more it felt like there's a need for me to say, no, I'm not that. I can't just passively allow that to be said about some part of me. I need to say something different.
Yeah.
So I guess that's how I'd say how I got to be more active. I found parts of the Czech Jewish community to be very welcoming. Other parts are quite strict. Like there are, the official community has a halachic definition of Jews. So if someone like me doesn't have a Jewish mother, then without undergoing Orthodox conversion, I can't be a member of the official Jewish community. But then there are liberal congregations that have been very welcoming. At the same time, I felt like they do things a bit differently than, they don't do a kind of the social justice Seder that I experienced in college, or they're not interested in the tradition of the Bund and Jewish socialism that for me is so much, such an important angle on what Jewishness means in the modern period. And definitely, you know, I'd have alienating discussions with specific people who don't necessarily, certainly don't represent the whole Czech Jewish community. But at some point, you know, I said to someone, for me, being Jewish means inscribing myself in this tradition of Jewish socialism that, I didn't give him the whole explanation of why it's important that I guess we'll talk about today, but he just shook his head and said, socialism has nothing to do with Jewishness. Jewishness has been about Israel for 2,000 years. So that's the end of the story. So when you hear that kind of thing, it makes you feel like, okay, that's not maybe the place for me. You know, I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't engage with those people, but.
Yeah, I mean, there are some very different understandings of what it means to be Jewish, where it's the idea that it's a national community that has always been about Israel, as this person you were talking to said, or as you were saying, the idea that to be a Jew is to kind of identify with the other, to kind of seeing yourself as, I mean, the ger, the inside outsider, as Rabbi David Cooper put it, which when you were saying that really made me think of Daniel Kahn's song, The Jew in You, which is all about how he understands Jewishness entirely through this lens of the other, the idea that the Jew in you is the inner other, the other that is not going to be fully accepted into the society that it's a part of, but is nevertheless part of that society. And the idea that as Jews, we should center that experience. And that's something that, of course, I mean, in that song, he emphasizes isn't something that's entirely Jewish at all. But by focusing on that element in Jewish history, we can develop a much more radical understanding of our Jewish identities.
Yeah, actually, when I first heard his song, I realized that he put into words a lot of what I've been trying to, you know, struggling to articulate for a long time. Yeah, I really love that song. It's funny, it's tongue-in-cheek, but it says, gets to the point.
Funny, tongue-in-cheek, gets to the point. That's what we're going for here, and that's what we're going to be talking about today when talking about your declaration of the diaspora. I like the song as well. My dad showed it to me, and then the first time I looked at it, I saw, oh my God, is it like 9 minutes? And then I had listened to the whole thing and enjoyed it. But it doesn't fit too well on my Spotify playlist, I'm afraid. Sorry, Daniel. In terms of what we're talking about today and the Declaration of the Independence of Diaspora, it's obviously connected to the Declaration of the State of Israel as a parody of it, or tongue-in-cheek reference on it, if you may. The Declaration of State of Israel is a very important document in Israeli identity. We've seen it very much in last year's protests. They had these huge copies that they put out on demonstrations.
I might also add, I think I mentioned it in our last episode, but there is a copy of the Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel, a giant copy in front of my synagogue, which is very weird.
Really?
It doesn't really feel... Yeah, it feels very out of place, especially considering it's not the most... Like, it's part of the Reform movement, but the leadership isn't the most... Like, it's not a right-wing Zionist shul, but they still... It's much more of a liberal Zionist shul and has some peacenik efforts, but it's... Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous that that is there, and it definitely shows just how much that this document frames a lot of understandings of what Zionism is in diaspora.
We don't want Ben getting in trouble over here. It's not like the most right-wing Zionist elements of the Israeli political spectrum are particularly fans of the Declaration of Independence. Many of them don't like it very much, in the same way that, I guess, in America it's a little bit different because, I don't know, more time has passed. And a lot of the ideas around the American Declaration of Independence, at least in practice, were not that well supported by the right.
Seems a little silly to say all people, or I think it's literally just all men are created equal, and then have black people also be considered 3/5 of a person. So like...
Yeah. And I mean, in the case of the Israeli Declaration of Independence, it's not a legal binding document as well. So in terms of getting into your understanding of why this document has served you as an inspiration, I wanted to ask you a little bit about an article that you published a few months ago in Medium, titled There Is No Jewish State. Would you like to tell us a bit more about it? Because I think this really frames your understanding, and it really helps us as a companion piece to the declaration itself.
Well, maybe as a way of entering this conversation, I was just thinking of what Ben just said, because when I was living in Chicago during grad school, you know, I would often pass synagogues that would have a big sign on the lawn saying, I stand with Israel. And you know, I know that can mean different things for different synagogues. I understand that the feeling of many people that they want to stand with Israel. But it also, for me, was like, this is a sign saying, this is not for you. Like, this is a synagogue that is setting something up. It's a completely different understanding of what it means to be a part of Jewish tradition. So part of what I was doing in this article was trying to articulate what I think Jewish tradition should be. I mean, I should clarify that. I also think it's wrong to say Jewish tradition is only this one thing or only this other thing. I think there are at least two different strong principles that one can consistently find if looking for it in Jewish tradition, in the Torah, the Tanakh, in the Talmud, in debates since then. You can consistently read it as a story about a great society of the past, a nation that had a temple and that's looking to return to that temple and create a state with a state religion. There is evidence that you can amass for that kind of an understanding that will say that the realization of this project is returning to a land and establishing a state. I won't deny that, but I think there's also a counter tendency that to me is much more interesting, and I think is also a much bigger part of Jewish tradition. And I also think it's the more historically compelling part for so many people, if they stop and think about it, which is the part of Jewish tradition, Jewish narratives, that's about having been expelled from Eden, having been lost in and enslaved in Egypt, escaping from Egypt, being lost in the desert, wandering. The Torah ends before having returned to the land. So yes, there's this story of return, but it ends before the return. And then, yeah, there's a continuation of return in the rest of the Hebrew Bible. But then there's another round of exile and another round of exile, and then the Bible ends, and then there's another round of exile, which is, you know, the current one, under which actual rabbinical Judaism developed. And for me, what I think of, like, the stuff that's in the Bible, the first half of the Bible doesn't really describe Jewish religion or Jewish way of being. It describes an Israelite and then a Judite way of being. And then that's kind of the backstory for what comes after, which is Jewishness emerges after the temple is destroyed and after all those states are no longer there. And that's what it came to be after the rabbis and the community figured out what to do after the temple was gone, after they didn't have a central authority, either a state or a high priest and hierarchy, and created something that to me is much more interesting than the actual religion that functioned under the temple.
So could you summarize what your thesis in that article is, that there is no Jewish state?
Yeah, so my basic argument is that by founding a Jewish state, that act of founding actually negates this kind of Jewishness that I see as the most interesting part of Jewishness. So refounding the Jewish state means we're no longer this kind of Jewishness that was developed after the temple was destroyed, after the old Israelite and Judaic state were conquered. So you can found a new state and you can call it Jewish, but it whatever it creates will be, of course, a negation still is some kind of a continuation of what came before it. So it's not that it has nothing to do with Jewishness, but it's definitely a very different thing from what emerged over those 2,000 years.
This isn't something I'd planned to talk about, but the use of the word Jewishness and the use of the word Judaism, we often see these as synonyms, but it's interesting to kind of unpack the distinction here, where Jewishness here is this idea of what it means to be Jewish at a personal level, and at a way that really is in dialogue with this 2,000 years, 2,500 years of exile, depending when you want to start that timeline. While Judaism is much more rooted in this state ideology, this fact that, I mean, most historians will say that the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, these are things that were created largely to justify rule, to justify the Judaic kingdoms, and as texts that are much more about legitimizing state rule. And that's something that's very interesting to kind of think about in the way that Judaism in its modern form that has been largely colonized by Zionism contradicts the Jewishness that you or I might be centering in our own understandings of our identities.
I would say the Tanakh is written with both purposes in mind. Like, some parts are written to justify we are setting up a new state, and this is the story we're going to tell you. Some parts, it's known that it was written under in these conditions. In other parts, they're written under exile, and it's to explain how we can survive in exile and how we can make sense of our life in exile. And we see moments of real kind of solidarity and understanding of what it means to be a foreigner in a foreign land and things like that. So I see both of these things in there. And well, one of the reasons I like to write about Jewishness compared to Judaism is, in part, I think Christianity has really colored what we understand religion to mean. So Judaism didn't emerge as a faith in the Christian sense originally. It had its own set of like rituals and meaning of loyalty and solidarity and community. And even today is much more focused on practice than on belief in God. But the word now is understood as a religion. And Jewishness is something that I feel like it's much easier for someone to understand what secular legacy of this tradition of practice might mean if we call it Jewishness, which is also a way of translating the Yiddish word, Yiddishkeit, mm-hmm. which is difficult to translate, but can mean, of course, Yiddishness, but it can also mean Jewishness.
I think something that you touched upon in the article is a point of nuance that of course, comes to us from one of the earliest Zionist thinkers, Ahad Ha'am, about the difference between a Jewish state and a state of Jews, or a state of the Jews, which is something that I've been thinking about a lot recently, specifically in that articulation between Jewish spaces and spaces of Jews, specifically in the context that I know the best, which is student communities in the diaspora, and whether or not there are differences between the two and important nuances that we miss. just like, you know, the question of diaspora and exile may be one that we may look at.
Yeah, I find Hadham very interesting. I'm not one of those people who think we should just throw out the Zionist legacy. I think there's an interesting history of thinking about the land, struggling with these questions that are complicated questions. And Ha'am is interesting because he was interested in establishing a Jewish community that would be meaningfully Jewish in the land, which for him didn't in the first place mean calling on all Jews to emigrate there. It meant having a kind of cultural center. But he thought eventually we could have something called a Jewish state if it's really developed its Jewish culture and isn't just declaratively Jewish as just like any other nation state, but this place, the people who happen to live there are called Jews and are classified in that way. What I would say in response is that I think it's a contradictory position because in my understanding of Jewishness, if you found a state, it's already going to undermine that principle of Jewishness. So any state that you found as a nation state will just be a state of Jews, but not a Jewish state. The Jewishness of it will be lost.
I do want to transition towards the Declaration of Independence of Diaspora that you wrote. There's a number of things I want to unpack in what you just said as well, because often one of the biggest critiques we'll get of diasporism as we present it is that this state of Jewish homelessness or statelessness is something that ultimately leads to death and suffering, and there's no way to solve that without the creation of some Jewish majority state. And obviously, we disagree with that. We have other ideas in mind, and I do hope that we can articulate some of those at the end of this episode. But another thing I wanted to think about is the framing of diaspora versus the framing of exile, because often these are seen as synonymous, and you almost use them as synonymous in the document. But I think they have pretty significantly different connotations, where diaspora, I mean, it's a beautiful word, diaspora. We've kind of talked about that word in the episode we did with Zevi from Seekers of Unity. But exile is a word that implies that we were kicked out of a place and is still always, if you're exiled from a place, you're exiled from a place, meaning that it's intrinsically bound to the place from which you were exiled from. So I was wondering how you see these two words relating to each other, and then we'll move into reading through this declaration that you authored.
It's a really good question, and the interconnection is really complicated. I mean, one way of looking at it would just be to say, like, there's exile is a bad version and diaspora is kind of a positive version. But I see it as a little bit more complex because I don't want to see just diaspora as only something good. I think part of what's valuable is this pain of recognizing a certain kind of homelessness. But the point for me is to recognize it as something more existential that gives us a path towards recognizing other people's situations, so it can be a means of solidarity. Instead of pointing to the actual physical homeland that we were kicked out of, points to an idea of redemption and return that everyone should have the right to. So I think both of these sides are important. Also, even the word diaspora, it's a beautiful word. It's also interesting how, I can't remember if you talked about this in any previous episodes, but the Hebrew word, if I remember correctly, so there's the word for exile, but the word that's actually translated in the Septuagint as diaspora, means something like abomination. So like the first place it appears in the Bible is where God says, and in this after exile, and you will be an abomination to the other nations. Like you will be spread among the nations and you'll be something terrible to them. But then the kind of the Greek mentality translating this in for Jews in Alexandria, I suppose, thinks of it as, for some reason, they don't give it this negative connotation. It's spreading seeds, diaspora. It's not an abomination. We're just going to be spread around and maybe we'll see the positive thing of, like, for example, of our life in Alexandria as people who were translating it were in this diaspora.
Yeah, and I might add, as someone that grew up and is coming out of the Reform movement, the early Reform movement, which didn't really organize until the 1880s, but the proto-movement that led to it was very concretely diasporist. The Philadelphia platform that wasn't fully adopted because there wasn't really an organized movement to adopt it. But the first point in it is that the messianic aim of Israel is not the restoration of the old Jewish state, but the union of all the children of God in the confession of the unity, so as to realize the unity of all rational creatures in their call to moral sanctification. So all that to say that Jews have seen and argued that there's actually something gained in this dispersal. And that's actually something that's become really core to a lot of people's Jewish identities by the modern period.
Yeah, and that's an example of the religious mentality actually being more capable of metaphorical thinking that opens up political possibilities, whereas the practical Zionist mentality takes this very literally and says, it's not a metaphor, we're returning to the land, which isn't to say, I mean, sometimes we need to be concrete, practical,
yeah,
and not just lost in metaphors. But this is one thing where I think the metaphor is more valuable than the actual physical return.
So I would love to move towards the Declaration of Independence of Diaspora. We were thinking that you could read it and we could just kind of stop at a couple points and discuss.
Yeah, I'll start reading. Our true birthplace was an exile, not when one man plotted out land and called it his, not when another built a palace and some elders declared him king, not when his son built a temple and made it the center of his land, but when we were kicked out of Eden, it was then that we were born. It was while wandering the desert, not when carving it up with fences, that we learned to let its flowers bloom. It was not statehood that made us, but slavery in Egypt, captivity in Babylon, and scattering like seeds across the coasts of imperial Rome. We have seen our mothers' mothers kidnapped to Assyria and Persia and banished back again. We have seen uncles and nephews in the libraries of Alexandria, the gardens of Granada, in the schools of Vilnius and the market stalls of Salonika, until they had to leave there too. We have seen friends trudging past the Himalayas, Balkans, and Carpathians to play for the nation's cabarets and courts, to fix the nation's pots and sharpen their knives. We have seen sisters and brothers driven from Africa to work so that the nations could have rights and states. We have seen others thrown by the waves of every sea, floating on capsized rafts, turned back from every nation's shore. We have seen our cousins chased at gunpoint from their homes and fields, sent from their ancestral lands in the name of ending exile, in the name of making us a nation like the others. We've had enough of that kind of nation. We do not want to learn from them the arts of home design. We have learned the art of homesickness so that we can see the homesickness of others. We have learned to roam, sojourn, stray, dawdle, loiter, and meander. Also, kick about, straggle, gallivant, trespass, traipse, flâner, drift, and sometimes stroll. But when the oppressors and rulers weren't looking, we also learned the arts of struggle. We have seen suffering, but we have also climbed to the mountaintops and seen that the world is large. It was when we stood there, knowing that we have not yet found the world's center and may never reach its ends, it was then that our nation came of age and realized that it needs no fatherland or motherland or promised land. In the name, therefore, of Jews, half-Jews, crypto-Jews, impostor-Jews, Jew-curious and barely Jewish Jews, as well as Gentiles and everyone beyond or in between, let us hereby declare the independence of diaspora from all states, including but not limited to the State of Israel. We make special appeal to the Israeli inhabitants of diaspora to participate in its upbuilding on the basis of full and equal representation in all its provisional and permanent institutions.
So when you make the statement that we hereby declare the independence of diaspora, and then mention at the end of that part that we want equal and full representation in all its provisional and permanent institutions, what institutions do you have in mind for an independent diaspora?
Well, I'll start by saying that this is a collectively written document. I wrote the first version, and then other people in our group, Jewish Voice of Solidarity in Prague, people made comments, had ideas, worked through different things. But the initial idea, it partly came about from this feeling that these topics are so serious and so big, it's hard to talk about them in new ways. And maybe if we can say something that's a little bit extreme, a little bit absurd, a little bit humorous, can also help us understand those serious things in new ways. So for example, diaspora is not a state, but it does need institutions. I think it does need institutions. And we can kind of jokingly think about what state-like or para-state institutions diaspora forms. As one example, you might have heard this idea in the linguistic discussions of the difference between a language and a dialect. And the great Yiddish linguist Weinreich. He said that at one of his lectures, someone came up to him afterwards and said, the difference between a language and a dialect is that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. That's the famous line.
Mm-hmm.
And so people will say, okay, so Yiddish never had an army and a navy, therefore Yiddish isn't a language. Well, I say, well, actually, maybe the Bund was the Yiddish's and the Yiddish newspapers were its navy that were sent across the Atlantic and all the way to Australia. So these kinds of institutions can do a lot of what states can do. They can protect traditions and languages from being wiped out. They can lay claim to modernity, which is kind of what nationalism also is. It's a claim to be able to say, like, we have the right to continue to exist in this modern world of states. Diaspora can form these kinds of institutions that allow people who aren't the nominal nation of a nation state to still survive as peoples with their traditions.
I wanted to comment on something that, well, two things that come to mind for me. And one is I don't know if asinine is the right word. Not a comment I take with too much seriousness, but I know that for some people that might be an idea that comes who are listening to this. But just on the first point is, I think there's a difference between when we're presented with this sort of grand narrative of the Jewish diaspora has been 2,000 years of exile and oppression and misery and suffering and death and everything. And it's just presented in that sort of way. It's one thing to say that that is an oversimplification, that lacks nuance, that yes, of course, there have been periods of great suffering. There have also been periods of cultural flourishing and development. And so it's one thing to say that and present sort of the two sides of that. And the third side of that is also the struggle that is understood as justified for building a better world, that yes, maybe the situation is bad now, but that's not a reason not to fight for a better world and not to fight wherever Jewish communities are. There's this line, I always forget if it's Peretz, Yudlamed Peretz, that said it in the early 20th century, that Zionists say that we should retreat from the battlefield. We do not retreat from the battlefield, which is a very sort of militaristic way of saying it. And I'm not sure I completely agree with that kind of framing. But there's one thing of saying it that. And then there's the other way, which is to say that exile happened and exile caused misery. And that misery taught us, or it built us in this way, and framing in that positive way. I think that's a little bit of a different point. And it touches on this sort of idea that, like, Jews are like the eternal misery people that need to wander the earth and in suffering, because that's their role in that way. And sort of some of the framing, and I understand, you know, not to take it too literally in the way which is constructed, but that's something that I think that someone who's not looking at the document already in, like, in a sympathetic way will think of that. Likewise, in terms of the line of we call on, you know, the Israeli people to connect in this process. First of all, I think it's quite interesting because that in the way in which this document is structured, I believe that this is a direct reference to the line about the Arab population, the state of Israel, as it was declared. And whatever the intentions may have been of the writers and signatories of the declaration, we know how a lot of that turned out in practice. And so I wouldn't like to have diaspora and diasporism understood and framed as the idea of Jews are better off in diaspora in 2024 today than Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael. There's something superior in that way. First of all, because I don't think that's inherently correct. And second of all, I think that sort of also teeters on the idea of thinking about solutions to Israel-Palestine that teeter on anybody leaving the land, which I also think is going down a dangerous road. So I was just wondering what on those two points would be relating to that, to the preamble and first part of the declaration.
Yeah, maybe I'll start with the second point. For me, the important thing about appealing to the Israel inhabitants is to say that they are already inhabitants of diaspora. Calling on them to participate in diaspora means welcoming them to this global community. Maybe there's chutzpah saying, like, no, we're the global community and you can join us, instead of the usual way, which is, we are the real Jewish community, why don't you come here? But I definitely don't see it as a call for them to leave Israel. Israelis can recognize themselves as being a part of this existential diaspora and this practical community that has real institutions that don't have to speak Yiddish. Yiddish is the, you know, one way into it for some of us who like are interested in this legacy. I don't think Israel succeeded in establishing a Jewish state. I think it succeeded in establishing an interesting Israeli cultural space where Jews can still be Jews as long as they are part of this global diaspora, and also Israeli culture can still exist in its own way, which is kind of the way someone like Ahad Ha'am look at Israel, as Eretz Israel, as being a part of, not Eretz Israel as a part of diaspora, but the actual political system there was not, it was still part of this broader world that doesn't have a Jewish state yet. We might have many theological differences with Haredim, but this idea that there isn't a real Jewish state until the Messiah has come, I think there's something really interesting in that idea, which is that we have this need to hesitate, this need to say, like, wait, hold on, maybe what this thing that claims to be redeeming us isn't really the real thing yet. And so we're still in diaspora as long as we aren't all saved. And since I don't think that the Jewish Messiah is likely to come anytime soon, I think we're stuck fighting it out amongst ourselves here on earth. And maybe that brings us to this question of exile as something that can teach us something. I think, yeah, exile doesn't make you better, but being too comfortable is very dangerous. I think people should be comfortable, but they should not forget the discomfort of others. So I do think that's something that this kind of experience of exile, however anyone is able to experience it, can teach them, and it's something that shouldn't be forgotten. And so the declaration, yeah, it's written from the perspective of someone who is inscribing themselves in the Jewish experience of, or say, historical memory of exile, but it's also an attempt to connect that to many other experiences. So the Roma, let's say wandering, there's not a Roma idea of having been exiled from northern India, but of moving and then being treated as not being at home in the places where they live. And there's very much a notion of the Black African diaspora, which is of course inspired by Black churches and their understanding of diaspora from the Bible. And there's, and of course, that experience of slavery is so huge that it would require its own, and it has its own literature of declaring independence and talking about what that means.
Yeah, I mean, as I've studied the Black Power movement, I do kind of understand the Black Power movement as a Black diasporist tradition, as these are people that fully embrace their identities while also asserting their right to belong in the places they call home, despite these long histories of trauma, exile, and diaspora. I do want to move forward, as we've been talking for quite a while already. And this next part of the declaration, I think, is very interesting because it really raises the question of what geographically is diaspora, especially how it relates to the Palestinian experience of diaspora and what that might look like regarding this next section, which is titled "The Right of Return to Diaspora Will Be Open to All." So if you could start reading from there.
The right of return to diaspora will be open to all persons born of Jewish mothers with proof of their mother's Jewishness evidenced by the signatures of at least two rabbis. Persons with at least one Jewish grandparent, Jewish persons living in the state of Israel who question whether they belong there. Jewish persons living outside the state of Israel who may like to visit someday, but not right now. Persons vaguely interested in, fascinated by, or confused by Jewish tradition. Persons who don't care in the least about Jewish tradition. Non-Jewish migrants and refugees in the state of Israel. Palestinians thrown into diaspora by the state of Israel. All people, everywhere, who have no home. All other people, everywhere.
So what does that mean, especially the line, Palestinians thrown into diaspora by the state of Israel? What does it then mean to say that the right of return to diaspora will be open to them? Or is this kind of tongue-in-cheek to say that diaspora is everywhere and they have the right to return to their homeland, which can be seen as part of this wider tradition of global diaspora?
We actually had a discussion internally about how to phrase that part because, the Palestinian diaspora is a different diaspora. I mean, every diaspora is different. And so there is a difference at the present moment between us having long traditions in places where we are, or choosing, for in my case, to move to a new city and claiming it as a place where I can be at home, and being in that moment when they are continually being thrown off of their land. I think of it as we want diaspora to be something that is open to everyone and that sees it as its mission to find a place for everyone and to defend everyone's right to be where they are. It's completely understandable for Palestinians now to want to return to their specific places from which they were kicked out. And it's understandable to want to establish a Palestinian state. If I were part of that community, I would have my own position and I would be able to say, you know, whether I think having a nation state of Palestinians versus being part of a one state solution or a federation, those are all important positions that can be debated. So, you know, diaspora, no one should be thrown into diaspora by political conditions. I think we all are thrown into diaspora by our existential conditions, but we need to struggle with what this means and how to bring people together. And there is an element of tongue-in-cheek in this list, of course, where it goes from more specific to including everyone, of course.
Yeah. I do want to raise the point that you bring up at the very beginning of it, which is that you understand diaspora originating in being kicked out of Eden, which is not actually something I had thought about, because I kind of think of diaspora as something that emerges in Babylon and in that tradition of like historical diaspora that we can really like identify as points in which people were exiled and many decided to stay in the places they were able to find home in afterwards. But it's very interesting to kind of think about diaspora as something that originates in being kicked out of Eden or the migration out of Africa, because in some sense, everyone is part of the human diaspora. And in that sense, we can kind of think about how we do move towards an internationalist framework for our future that doesn't rely on nation states.
That's exactly the idea I had behind it, which admittedly is an extension of the way the term is used in Jewish tradition, which the Bible doesn't use the term diaspora to talk about being kicked out of Eden. My interpretation is that when the Torah was edited later, after an understanding of diaspora or of exile, let's say, was shaping it, my hypothesis is that this was one of the reasons that Eden and being kicked out of Eden becomes such an important narrative moment in the story. And again, the story of enslavement and exodus from Egypt, which are also not called diaspora, but is this repeated narrative that then becomes the narrative used to talk about these later stories. So then the specific Jewish diaspora can be seen as a case of this universal diaspora.
Shall we continue? It's been just really great listening to this and putting in a comment here or there. But apart from that, just rehearing the document after hearing it the first time is really a pleasure.
Diaspora makes no guarantees, but it calls on all who live in it, irrespective of religion, race, or sex, to struggle for their rights and the rights of their fellow travelers. We extend our hand to all the nations as they prepare to renounce their states, and to all states if they are willing to forget their nations. The borders of diaspora are everywhere and nowhere and can be crossed at any moment. The A national anthem of diaspora is declared to be a medley of Die Schwue, the march of the unemployed, wayfaring stranger, follow the drinking gourd, and Jelim Jelim, with several measures open for improvisation. The official diasporic languages will include Yiddish, Ladino, Judeo-Arabic, Shami Arabic, Shawi Arabic, Circassian, Judeo-Marathi, Amharic, Judeo-Tat, Polish, Czech, Ge'ez, Aramaic, Modern Hebrew, Yoruba, Kukichin languages, Armenian, Romani, Ukrainian, Rusin, Polynesian, German, Russian, Italian, Tamil, Esperanto, Slavic English deprived of articles, dialects, pidgins, and patois languages of all kinds, and badly pronounced Hebrew inflected with chapped lips and the slippery cadence of shtetl mud. This list of official languages will be continually adjusted and indefinitely expanded. Diaspora has no flag, but it may freely decorate the walls of the nations with stickers and graffiti, especially but not limited to the purpose of covering over fascist slogans. Ships of diaspora will sail under a flotilla of anti-flags. The Constitution of Diaspora will be drawn up when the diasporic people are ready to encode their shared values. Or never. Diaspora is patient and contains multitudes. The diasporic army will contain divisions of 1. Vagabonds disciplined by the sunrise and life on the road. 2. Workers with strong arms. 3. Scholars with sharp pens. And 4. Artists trained in tactics of encirclement, ambush, and guerrilla theater. The positions of president and prime minister will remain vacant until the revolution comes, enabling all people everywhere to be at home. Placing our distrust in contracts and covenants, we scatter this declaration unsigned across the lands of diaspora. It goes into effect immediately, from the moment it is read.
Well, I'm happy to be speaking one of those languages.
And it really, I think, captures the imagination for what this, I mean, it says this, once the revolution comes, for what this revolutionary future could look like, a future where there is no borders, where we can, I really especially love the line that we extend our hand to all the nations as we prepare to renounce our states, and to all states if they are willing to forget their nations. The idea that the nation state is one of the key institutions that actually holds us in and kind of encloses our imaginations for what could be. And of course, the list of languages is particularly beautiful. I think including Circassian is something that I've thought about, with the Circassian genocide being one that is not really talked about at all, and is deeply disturbing as one of the biggest genocides of the 19th century. And just to kind of recognizing that we can lay claim to these futures, especially if we're willing to think out what we might build to bring these into reality. I think going back to the idea of provisional and permanent institutions and what these might look like, so that we could actually build institutions so that we could actually model the type of world we want to build in the way that we organize. And this is something that I've been thinking a lot about. Zach and I have been pretty active in the effort to revive the Jewish Labor Bund, and I proposed this idea of a diasporist conference recently. Basically a federation model that could then be expanded to bring in delegates from existing organizations and partner organizations, so that we could actually build an umbrella body for the Jewish left in diaspora. And that's something that has been really a dream of mine since before we even started the podcast, of having some kind of organizing body and coordinating body for the Jewish left, because there's so many organizations, but they don't often have any real concrete partnership. And if they do work together, it's often pretty ephemeral. But we have kind of seen a move away from that recently. I know very recently in June, there was the first in-person meeting of the International Jewish Collective for Justice in Palestine, which was pretty significant. I believe it's groups from like 16 different countries. And there's also coordination going back for further with European Jews for a Just Peace. You have these coalitions that have been built that are often very narrow in their scope. And of course, often for coalitional organizing, you do need to have a pretty narrow scope. But the idea that we could actually bring these groups together for something greater, especially for this imagination, for this idea that we could actually reshape the world, especially in our relationship to this Zionist Judaism that is so state-based, I think it's very radical to imagine the opposite of that, a diasporic Judaism that actually models a internationalist future in which all people can live in the way that they'd like to live and have the freedoms that they should have, which is the freedom of movement, the freedom to live their lives and prosper and thrive without oppression anywhere. I really do love this document because I think it does encapsulate the sort of thinking that we need to be doing in order to build this better future. And I guess I was wondering what you thought would be the next step from this document. What sort of organizing do you think it should lead to in your own community and internationally?
I'll just say again, this line about extending our hand is one of these references to the Israeli Declaration of Independence, which I think part of the power, for me, the power of looking at this declaration is to see how they sound quite nice in the declaration. We can see how they failed. In my view, the declaration reads, the Israeli Declaration of Independence, "We extend our hand to all neighboring states and their peoples in an offer of peace and good neighborliness." But it's founded on this principle of nation states. So exactly, this seemed to me to call for a kind of response where we have to extend our hands in different ways, organize in ways that don't ignore the existence of states, but that either force states to recognize more than just their nations as having rights, and to establish our own institutions that might work with states when they need to, but aren't dependent on these nation states. And I think this kind of like all this local organizing in federations is absolutely necessary.
One final point that I'm just going to make is about this word that I didn't think of previously in this context, but there's been a lot of discussion on the history of Jewish life in Poland and the connection made between Jews and non-Jews and the sort of proximity in which different communities lived to each other. And this word neighbors has had this particular importance because a neighbor is someone who you can have very, very close relationships with. It can be someone who you leave your kids with when you have to go somewhere, or it can be someone you absolutely hate and don't trust and don't speak to. And I'm going to leave a little bit of homework for our listeners if they want to hear more about what neighbors, particularly in the Polish-Jewish context, means to learn about. Joe, thank you so much for coming on to speak with us. It's been a real pleasure. We're going to wrap it up.
Just reminds me of what our friends at the Sirpod Collective emphasized in their understanding of diasporism, which is that diasporism is living with our neighbors. And it's, at a certain point, can be that simple when we look at the local level. And of course, when we zoom out in the international context, it's far, far less simple. It feels like this document takes us a step further towards concretizing what this international diasporist future might look like. So I really wanted to thank you and your work for creating this and for speaking with us today, Joe.
Well, thanks again for having me. And I just wanted to say also, since I didn't get to talk about our group very much earlier, the Jewish Voice of Solidarity in Prague, that it's really, maybe it's an example of this kind of local organizing that gives us a space to do things and figure out, you know, be ourselves, find out how to be ourselves, do things our own way, and look to the rest of the world and connect with the rest of the world. Thanks again also for your work and organizing as well as doing this podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hopefully we can bring the work you do in Prague into a wider sphere so that we can really build the institutions that we need to truly declare independence as diaspora. We are